Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're a regular viewer of Pop the History Makers, you'll know that I pride myself on my interviews and do a lot of research. They're slow burns, which means you have to watch the whole interview to really get the impact, because you do have to know the background of someone to really understand them. Now, coming up is what I think a really great interview with Dr. Robert of the Blow Monkeys. But first, please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to hear when I've put up a new interview on the site. So stay tuned, stick with it to the end. Here's Dr. Robert of the Blow Monkeys. Dr. Robert Howard, welcome. I know that I presume you're in Spain at the moment, where you've lived for a long time, I think.
Yeah, I live just outside Granada in Andalusia. Yeah, been here for 20 years.
Yeah, I moved to Germany in 94. And one thing I discovered about moving to another country, I'm now in Greece, by the way, so this isn't Germany. But one thing I discovered about moving to another country, it's like looking in a mirror and seeing yourself. You sort of see who you are in a different way and have a different perspective. How has living in another country changed you, or do you think it's changed you at all?
Well, we came here, my wife and I both have moved around quite a lot in our lives, so we were a bit nomadic anyway. And I wanted to give my kids, who were both in their sort of early years at that point, another culture, another life. You know, and also, you know, it's something as just as prosaic as the weather. It was another factor, and living a life outside. And I love this part of Andalusia because it's kind of got a lot of influence from North Africa here. There's just another way of life. And of course, you find out, you find out that what you have in common is more important than that. People are basically the same everywhere else. So it removes the fear of the other. My kids, you know, inevitably moved back to London because they had to, because they wanted to work and all that. But they're both reaching the stage now, I think, where they want to leave as well. So we kind of implanted that kind of attitude, I think. And I think that's really important because it just, like I said, it just removes the fear of the other. It means, you know, you embrace other cultures, other languages, other people.
When you were young, you were brought up with your sisters, who really were the ones that helped introduce you to music as a young person. What sort of music were you brought up around, and what sort of music did your parents like?
Well, my sisters were both 10 and 11 years older than me, and my brother, actually, but he was in the Navy. He was away, but I was the youngest by a good 10 years. So they went through the whole of the 60s thing. So every Beatles single, every kind of Burt Bacharach type thing, you know, a bit of Aretha Franklin. My mum was a massive jazz fan, so she loved Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald. My dad was more kind of Perry Como. I'm sort of turning into my dad because I love Perry Como. So there was a while, there was all that was coming in the house. My younger sister in particular was listening to everything really, like, Beatles, but also Simon and Garfunkel. The kind of the big records that were around at that time would have been by the time I was sort of 8 or 9 were Abbey Road and Bridge Over Troubled Waters and Queen of Soul, Aretha. And but I was more transfixed at that point in my very early years by Glenn Miller. I'd seen the Glenn Miller story on telly, with James Stewart, and I was just totally, and still am, hooked on his music. But the first thing that kind of turned me on, obviously for my generation, I think, and for a lot of people, was probably seeing Mark Bolan on Top of the Pops circa 71. That would have been the life-changing kind of, oh, well, what world is that,
That's interesting because I remember for me, it was Bowie. We're about the same age. I'm a couple of years older. And mine was in the early 70s, 72, I think, seeing Bowie on Top of the Pops. And for me, being a young gay teenager at that point, Bowie provided a world where I felt maybe I could belong in this world and didn't really feel that I belonged in the world of my parents. I mean, we're talking a very different era, obviously.
Absolutely.
Was Mark
Absolutely.
Bolan someone that provided a different world for you where you felt a belonging?
I don't know if I belonged. I mean, I was living in a place called King's Lynn in Norfolk, which was really a kind of outpost, a London overflow town, a sort of, but it was a weird anomaly because it was a soul town. There was a lot of kids were into Northern Soul. I was just a little bit too young to go, but I had friends who were. There was a record shop in King's Lynn called the Soul Bowl. So a lot of my memories of early soul music as well. It would have been things like Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye and Al Green, and then the kind of more sort of obscure kind of Northern Soul tunes and stuff, and even things like listening to Band of Gold, standing freezing at King's Lynn football ground, listening at the half time. And that would come on and be sort of transported. So soul music was a massive thing for me. Mark Bolan was like, well, that's another world. He seemed to be from outer space to me. He kind of just preempted Bowie in my world. Bowie I came to a bit later, especially during the kind of Berlin period. So yeah, but I mean, and I loved singles. I loved the whole glam rock thing at the time. I loved just the magic of that. But it wasn't a world that I recognized because it was, I seem to be living in black and white, and that, but it was a refuge for the freaks and for the outsiders, that's for sure. I mean, the kind of, you go to school and there would be the Slade fans who were the, macho, and I definitely wasn't macho. So it was definitely a kind of, it was a big divide, I mean, you've got to remember, I mean, you recognize this more than I do, to wear a hint of makeup or anything like that as a male or any kind of androgyny in the kind of early 70s was a brave statement. Even though the mods had done a bit of that in the sort of 60s, the kind of peacock thing, it was a very different world, and it was you had to be brave.
I mean, you mentioned Freda Payne's Band of Gold, and I know it's associated very closely with your father. You mentioned that watching football games with your father, and your father died when you were at a young age. How did that impact you? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this in a second, because I think an event like that can impact you greatly in your life and actually provide also a drive in your life.
I think my father was he was 50 years old when I was born, so he was almost a Victorian figure. And I saw him as a sort of quite distant, semi-authoritarian, almost godlike figure, to me as a little boy. And so, to cut a long story short, he died when I was about 14, 15, just at the point when I was sort of growing up. And I felt a mixture of absolute trauma and deep, deep sorrow with a kind of guilty feeling of freedom, because the life that I think that he had planned for me and that I was being led towards had suddenly disappeared. It coincided with me and my mum moving to Australia, which was like going from the black and white of King's Lynn to the colour of Sydney, it was just like, whoa, hang on a minute. And at the same time, you know, I mean, so it sent me on a spin, really. It sent me on a kind of, on a journey. You know, I learned to play guitar, started busking, I started writing songs. It was pretty obvious that I wasn't going to go into the services, which is every other male in my family had done. There's no fucking way that I was going to go into any of that. So it sent me spinning, and I'm still probably spinning.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of, I suppose you can say it's a theory, but like reading a lot about you and listening to your music and feeling like maybe you felt a sense of injustice when your father died. And I think every young person would, because why me? Why does this happen to me? So it's a sense of injustice. And one thing that's been a theme in your music is writing injustice. You know what I mean? Trying to write about the injustice in society and creating tracks which are confronting injustice. So I just wondered if there is a connection to that, or you could see that.
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask. I don't really analyze myself to that degree, but I think there is a, I mean, in terms of injustice, I mean, it was music that politicized me. It would have been the punk generation, and reading The Enemy and reading Melody Maker, especially The Enemy at the time, there were writers on there that were better than some of the things they were writing about, and they would drop names in there and you'd go and search it. And so I grew up in what was basically, I think, to be honest, was a working class Tory family. And, you know, because they saw conservatism as aspirational. And I thought something didn't click with me. And I think that I became politicized through music. And so I was always tremendously impressed by those people that took, like John Lennon, that took risks with their image and had the power to say something. And then later on, the kind of Joe Strummer, Paul Weller generation of politicized punk groups. I mean, I see now the naivety in some of it and all that, but at the time it really kind of opened my mind to the possibilities. And then you go back and you think, oh, of course, you know, Marvin Gaye, what's going on? Or, you know, you find out about The Last Poets or, you know, Gil Scott-Heron, and you think, oh, there's this whole tradition of amazing music that has something to say within it. Dylan, obviously, as well. You know, so I've always thought it was a perfect vehicle. I never thought that the two were incompatible. So I don't know if it was so much as a reaction to my father. I mean, certainly it was a reaction as much as I felt free, guiltily free. But I was also deeply traumatized by his loss because I loved him very much. And I think that those two things combined to send me on a bit of a journey.
Yeah, you said, you know, you went to Australia with your mum and it was a sort of colourful world in comparison to the black and white world of King's Lynn where you were brought up.
Yeah.
So when you got to Australia, what was your introduction to the music scene in Australia?
Well, the first band I ever saw were on their equivalent at the Top of the Pops, it's called Countdown, introduced by Molly Meldrum, and it was it was The Saints. And they just blew my mind. And then I went to see them. So I thought, my God, you know, you've got to remember, no bands ever came to King's Lynn. And suddenly I'm in Sydney and all these bands are coming. Like I saw the Ramones there, the Stranglers, all the punk bands came, but the indigenous, if you like, Australian bands, you know, the Saints and the Nick Cave's first band called the Boys Next Door. And there were other bands like Radio Birdman and later on, the Laughing Clans. It just blew my mind. I just thought, this is fantastic, you know. And I'd never been in that environment before, so I was so totally immersed in inner city Sydney and everything that came with that.
Was it easy for you to make contact in the music scene? Because I know you became friends with bands like the Go-Betweens, didn't you? So you would have known Grant McLennan and people like that.
Well, I didn't. I wouldn't say I was friends with them. No, I knew. Ed Cooper Moore from the Laughing Clans and my wife, I married Linda very young when I was over there. She was working for Ram magazine and all that. So we, you know, I was only 19. But we all came back to London in 81. And I think the Go-Betweens and the Birthday Party and the Laughing Clans all came back at the same time. And they all went to live in Earls Court. and I went to live in East Dulwich. And, But I wasn't really part of that thing. I was just a bit younger than them, and probably to them, sort of slightly annoying, inconsequential kid that was hanging about, saying, I'm going to do it as well,
So you came back with a different frame of mind, in a sense. You
Oh
came
yeah,
back
I
with.
came back. Oh yeah, I came back. I mean, this is, 80, 1980, we left, started traveling around Australia to come back to London. London, pre-internet, so there's no, the idea was, I'm going to go back and I'm going to form a band. I had no idea what I was going to do. I'd been busking in Sydney. I'd been writing songs, but they were god awful. But once somebody stops and puts a little bit of money in the hat, the first time you're sort of hooked, So I came back and I did that classic thing of answering an ad in the back of Melody Maker, which is where I found Neville, Jackson's Lane Community Centre. I started plotting from there on, but it was very difficult for those first few years because I didn't know anybody. I had no connections. But you could live on the dole. You could live on the dole. You could sort of, there were people living in a squat still in London. There was still a kind of community. There was a safety net within which you could kind of learn to be creative.
There was also like a club scene in the early 80s. I don't know if you ever went to clubs like Cha-Cha's, but the sort of forerunners of Taboo. There were all these clubs that had a very mixed creative crowd. And I moved to London in 82, and similarly, being on the dole, but you could still go out, you could go to warehouse parties, but you could connect with people who were doing things creatively. Was the club scene in the early 80s, before the Taboo era, part of your life?
Definitely. Because I'd made friends with Hector, who was DJing at the Wag at the time, but also there were clubs like the Flim Flam, and there were obviously Taboo, but pre-Taboo, we would, yeah, I can't even remember the names of them now, but I had friends like in the fashion industry, like Judy Blame, who I'd made, and Dave Baby, and people like that that I'd met through Michelle. And so I was being drawn into that world, and really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was really vibrant, good people, and exciting and edgy, And we were a little bit gothy as well at the time, so I was sort of drawn into that thing. Yeah, it was an exciting time. It was an exciting time.
So tell me about, the first track you actually made, which was Live Today, Love Tomorrow, and what the feeling of the band was at that time, and how you actually saw yourself, whether you were really seeing yourself as a serious band, or this was just like, oh, we'll try this and see what happens.
No, I always saw it as a serious thing. We were rehearsing down in this place called Sleazy's, which is next to the prospect of Whitby and Wapping Mall. It really was sleazy, but the guy who ran it had a record label and heard us rehearsing and said he put a single out. So, I mean, I was writing, 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 just to keep the band together, to go in every week and say, we're going to give up our jobs, no jobs, we're going to go for this. This is it, and I'm going to write, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I tried to get better. And that was just one song that came out as we went along. Live Today, Love Tomorrow, not very, profound or even very good, but it seemed to fit. And but there was never any question in my mind that this is what I wanted to do. Partly because I thought, what the fuck else can I do? Maybe be a cricketer, I once thought, or maybe a journalist, I once thought. Nah, I loved it, and I really believed in it. And to their credit, Mick and Neville in particular, and at the time Angus, stayed by through thick and thin when we had no gigs, no prospects, didn't know anybody. It was really tough. It was just a belief, and the way I kept it afloat, I think, was continually writing and coming in and playing them and saying, this is what we are. I used to write long letters about, like manifestos. This is what the Blow Monkeys stand for. And just as important, this is what we don't. This is what we're not.
So what weren't you?
Oh God, we're not going to use delay pedals like U2, I remember saying. We're going to have organic guitar sounds and things like that were very important. It was as important as what you were against as what you were for,
How
But
did you
I think that the madness of my kind of belief in it held us together through those very early days when it could, and probably most most bands fall apart at that point. I think that's the difference. I think you just, I was very lucky, and Mick and Nev in particular, who I'm still with, we're like family because we've had this amazing experience together.
How did you attract a major at that point?
I've often asked myself that. I think at a certain point we started to get gigs, and the Moonlight Club, West Hampstead, offered us a Friday night residency for a month. And I used to meet Neville, you know, because, you know, this is pre-mobile phones and all that. So you'd make a date to ring a phone box. And somebody would be in it, which would be the worst thing. But then, and we would meet at the West End. And literally, I went around to publishers and record companies with a guitar and a cassette. I remember playing for people in Denmark Street. And eventually, you know, we got London Records, a guy called Tracy Bennett, to come down to see us. And he offered us a singles deal, and we were absolutely knocked out. London Records, you know. Wow. And then every week, more and more people started to come. And by the fourth week, a guy from RCA turned up called Jack Stephen, who said, I'll give you an album deal. Based on what, I don't know. I mean, just, we had a lot of fun, I think. And by the end, we were packing it out. And maybe there was something there. But he signed us on a bunch of tunes that didn't even make the first album. Because he signed us and he went into rehab shortly after. Sorry, Jeff. And so disappeared. And they had signed us and wondered what the hell they had. By this time, the Enemy had written a couple of nice reviews and stuff. And we were beginning to get at least a name and known, some, you know. And so they left us alone to kind of rehearse for 9 months while they figured out what to do with us. But they signed us, so they had to record an album, you know. So, but they did record an album. The first album was completely different to the one they signed us for, though.
Did you have complete freedom when you were created Limping for a Generation? Or were the record company on you?
No, they were free. I think they thought, we don't know what it is, but something there, and they're beginning to get good press. And I was also a bit bolshy, and so was our manager at the time, Linda, my first wife. I think they were a little bit in kind of, well, you know, at the time they didn't really have much RCA. They might have had Joe Boxers. The Eurythmics were starting out, but they didn't really have much. They didn't have anything like us. And I think they thought, well, we'll just leave them alone. There was a young talent scout working there who used to turn up at our gigs. And he was basically making tea in the offices at RCA. And his name was Corda Marshall. And Corda ended up being the big boss of RCA. But this time he was the tea boy. But he was our support. He was obviously saying to someone, listen, these are good. We were kind of like an indie band stuck on a major label. And at that time, people looked down their noses at better bands on major labels. It was better to be on Rough Trade or, you know. So, but we, you know, that was never really the intention. So, they left us alone. They, you know, I said, I want to use Pete Wilson and I want to have strings. And they said, all right, and here you go. They let us do it. I mean, unthinkable, really.
I mean, you mentioned that you had a lot of critical success, that people were writing about you in very positive terms. Yeah. But commercial success took quite a long time.
Yeah.
How important do you think it was that bands like Orange Juice opened up a sort of route for you, in a sense?
I think Orange Juice were massive influence. I mean, I remember watching, I went to see when we arrived in London, the Sound of Young Scotland, Postcards Records presents at the venue in Victoria. And I think Orange Juice were on, Joseph K, Fire Engines, might have been a very young Roddy Frame in there as well. But Orange Juice in particular, I thought Edwin, I still do. I love his writing. I loved his guitar playing. And even more than that, I loved his in-between song banter, because he was very acidic and sharp and funny. When Rip It Up broke through, I think it was a big moment for us as well. It's like, oh, you know, you can get through that kind of indie soul thing that he was doing, and the, you know, similar kind of thing. And like, So yeah, it was they were definitely a big inspiration on issues. Loved them.
I mean, this is when Animal Magic came out,
Yeah.
and then suddenly, and it wasn't really suddenly, it took a while, and it took till, I think it did take till Digging Your Scene, wasn't it? Until
Yeah.
you actually had commercial success. What
Yeah.
exploded that success?
We were kind of building up. Everything was building. We'd gone through the first album, then we put out Forbidden Fruit, which sort of crawled up just outside the top 40, and we were starting to get. But I had no idea that Digging. I think the thing about Digging was that I'd gone over to America. I'd gone to New York the first time in 1985. Corder, by this time, is our A&R man. Sent me out there. He said, go to Arthur Baker's studio and do a remix on that song, Digging Your Scene, that you've made before we release the album. So I went to Arthur Baker's studio thinking I was going to work with Arthur Baker. I ended up working with a guy called Michael Baker in Arthur Baker's studio. And Arthur Baker's studio was like unlike anything I'd ever seen. There was no instruments. It was wall-to-wall samplers and MIDI leads and all this. And Unique, it was called. And I spent about 2 weeks there. And I came back and I said to the band, you want the good news or the bad news? Because I think the good news is I think we've got a hit record. The bad news is you're not on it. At least the drums and bass are not on it. Because they had been replaced by the Lindrum, which was the sound of the 80s. That was it. Once you'd dance with the devil, it was difficult to go back. Everyone used to go, you've got to have that Hall & Oates drum sound, and all that rubbish. But anyway, I knew that this it's something had happened here. We flipped into another thing, and I felt very comfortable with it because I loved that music. I was really by this point, I'm living in Brixton with a DJ who's the in-house DJ at the Wag Club, and I'm getting exposed. I live above a record shop called Red Records on Brixton High Street. I'm totally exposed to early house music, hip hop. Everything like that was really in my system and in my life and in my blood, and I wanted us to be connected to that, so it was natural for me. But I still didn't expect. I think the big one was like they said, "Oh, you're doing Wogan next week," and this is before the record was released. And that's the power of that kind of mainstream television because this is four channels back then. That's all there was, and you go from playing to 200 to 2,000 overnight because everybody's seen you on there. And so, yeah, that was the life changer, Digging, because it was a hit in America as well.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
What was so powerful about that song? And for me as a gay man, I remember going out to clubs in London and people would disappear. So for me, it would be friends or even ex-lovers, and you'd
Yeah.
ask about them, and then they go, oh, they died.
Yeah.
And you know, this was a terrible period, and a period of where being gay, you were very ostracized
Yeah.
and treated very badly. And the lyrics, I just want to read you your own lyrics because they moved me totally at that period and made me feel a sense of belonging. I just got your message, baby. So sad to see you fade away. What in the world is this feeling? Catch a breath and leave me reeling. It'll get you in the end. It's God's revenge. Oh, I know I should come clean, but I prefer to deceive. Every day I walk alone and pray that God won't see me. And this, for me, in what I'd experienced in that period, was an amazing message. There were very few bands there were very few people in the world who actually referenced the AIDS crisis and referenced things that particularly people like me in that period could relate to. What reaction did you actually get to that song? Did people realise?
I don't think they did, if I'm honest. I don't think it was, there wasn't much made of it at the time. I mean, I did, you know, I was very fluid myself, you know, sexually in the early 80s. I was in those circles. I understood how important the gay scene had been, particularly to music and to fashion and to everything else. So I felt a kinship with that world, and I was particularly taken back by the government reaction to AIDS, you know, those kind of scare stories they were putting out, those horrific kind of tombstone advertisements that they were putting out. You remember all that stuff? And then Donna Summer saying that. I mean, I took that. I know she later kind of called back on that, but I remember her statement about it being God's revenge and stuff. This is a woman that had made her reputation in those clubs. So it was, to me, it was just an extension of right-wing thinking as well, of Thatcherism, of what was going on. I think that those words just flowed out of me. And I don't think anybody made much of it at the time. I don't remember it being an issue. I remember talking about it and saying, but I don't think it was ever really, it was picked up on more latterly, you know, afterwards. It was, what the song was about. It probably would have banned it on the radio because they did used to do things like that, just gently ignore it if they'd known. Yeah, I don't know. But for me, it was because that's the world I was moving in. There were the friends I knew, lots of. I also lost friends who just disappeared up close. And I still think about that when I sing the song. I can still kind of relate to the initial emotion that spawned it. Yeah. That's the power of music sometimes, you know.
I mean, this song became, I hate this word in a sense, but it's like your breakout song. It's a song that got you to America. It got you on Top of the Pops in Britain, which was, you know, as you mentioned, Wogan, you know, you had to be on Top of the Pops as well in that period to sort of get into the charts and have a massive hit. Also going to America. So how did your life change at that point, and what did it open up to you?
Well, I mean, we toured America and that was just astounding. You know, we flew in and the first gig was at Red Rocks supporting Robert Palmer, who was number one at the time with Addicted to Love, I think it was. It's like, you know, a couple of years ago, we were playing down the Prospect of Whitby and this damp kind of, and then we did American Bandstand with Dick Clark, you know, which was the big iconic show there. And meeting him was weird because I'd never met a living waxwork before. I had my moment in the sun. It was our little 15 minutes of like proper, like, you know, pop stardom. And I discovered that it wasn't for me, really. I wasn't going to be George Michael or even Simply Red, if you like, even that kind of level. We were a little bit too spiky for that, and I wasn't really comfortable with it. Although I played along with it a lot. I mean, I kind of think there was a while when, you know, the record company kind of put me on the front cover of all the records around that time, and they would change the color of my eyes and shave my cheekbones. And then so we got the kind of teeny bop girls would turn up sometimes at the gigs, and they'd look at the sleeve and look at me and wonder what's going on. And I wasn't really comfortable in that. I think it kind of was to the detriment maybe of the way that the music was taken in a certain sense, because I became a little bit of a kind of, for a little while there, one of the kind of pop pin-up guys, you know, to many people, probably indistinguishable from the guy from Aha, you know, which, you know, is my own fault because I played along with it for a little while. But it wasn't for me in the end, you know, it wasn't, I was never comfortable in that. I mean, I don't want to sound too pompous about this, but it really was always about the music. And it really has been about the music and about creating new music and carrying on as an artist and creating. That's the juice. All the rest of it around, you know, the cars stop coming, the phone calls, they inevitably that all falls away. And I think I knew that even then. I had good people around me as well, good friends. So it didn't, you know, it wasn't ever going to go to, I still lived in Brixton. They used to send these cards around to my flat in Brixton, you know, these flash cards to pick me up, to take it to the top of the pops. I take it away for fuck's sake. You know what I mean? You're blowing my cover. I'm living above in a little flat above a record shop in Brixton. I, you know, it just was, yeah, it was fun though. It was great fun. But I wasn't very good. I wasn't very good at being showbiz.
But going to the States gave you an opportunity to meet people. Isn't that where you met Curtis Mayfield?
No, actually, I met Curtis in London. He was playing at that time. He would have been playing Dingwalls to not many people, and I met him there and went and said, "I'd, you know, nice to meet you. I'd love to do a song." And he told me where hotel he was staying at, and I went up there and met him there and put the song on a cassette. And we did it. And yeah, no, he was an example of one of those guys that's. He doesn't. He didn't need to impress anyone. He just emanated calm and composure and was, yeah, guru like. I know it's a cliche, but he was like that. You know, I mean, he was a human being, flawed and all that, but incredible man to meet at that point in my life.
I mean, I read that you said he was a mentor as well as a friend.
Yeah,
In what
I
way
think
was
so.
he a mentor?
Well, he was. Because we did a bit of touring and we went to Switzerland and we did the Montreux TV Festival and we did some gigs as well. And, you know, he was like, you know, Robert, it's, you know, he was like the one that quoted me, the cars will stop coming one day and all that. He'd been through it all. And I think he was an example. You know, when I met him, I went into his hotel room. He was sitting on the bed with a guitar there and a notebook and he was writing a song. And I said, well, it was called Homeless. And the song came out about a year later. It's a beautiful song. And I thought, my God, even at this stage, he's still every spare moment, he's still, and he's writing. And it's not about him, it's about an issue. And it's about his compassion in his writing, still after everything that he's been through. And he'd been playing, you know, he'd been on a downward spiral, although he was about to come up again before the accident happened. So it was just an example of somebody who. The blind whale was music. That was the thing that will get you through. That was the message from him. Stay true to the music because that's what got you started and that's what will get you through.
I mean, you did the song Celebrate the Day After You with him, but
Yeah.
I just wonder, you know, you mentioned him as a mentor and friend, but I wonder what he learned from you.
Oh, I don't think he would have learned much from me. I think he was. I mean, I think he enjoyed what I remember. He enjoyed watching us play, and he came up and we did Superfly together at the Hammersmith Odeon. And he was very complimentary on his wife Althea. They were lovely, but you know, we were young and full of it. We were having a great time. We were on the up, and so he there's nothing much I could teach him, other than he obviously spotted something which was. Dare I say it, kind of authentic in the sense that it was about the music. It wasn't because I used to sit and play in the quiet moments. I was an absolute freak about the impressions, you know, and I knew all the impression songs. So I'd sit and play. Do you remember this one? It's like a B-side, you know. What's this one about? Well, you know, and he was like, "Whoa, you know." And then I tried to play his guitar once and it was impossible because he tuned it all to F sharp, like all the black notes on the piano. It was impossible. And that's how he got his sound. But he realized that I was deep into what he was doing. It wasn't just like, oh, then, you know, let's find somebody and do a duet with it. I absolutely loved everything he did right from the beginning, and knew it.
When other people sort of mention what they glean from you, is it authenticity? Is it your knowledge of music? Is it your love of what you do? What do you th where would you define it?
That's not for me to say. I really don't know. I don't even know if I even have that effect on people. I think it's, I mean, I've been through a lot of ups and downs in the sense of just like anybody else in the life with music. I've had those moments where everything's been going right, and then it's all fallen away, and you're playing to nobody on you, and all I can say is that in those moments, I've still been able to put myself in the moment with the music. The music has been my guide. So if there's anything that I do have, it would be it does come from an authentic place where I need to express. And also, when I was younger, I wasn't very good on the kind of one-to-one, you know, like a social thing. And yeah, I could sing things to lots of people that I couldn't say on a one-to-one. It's that kind of weird anomaly I think you find in some performers. So there was a need to express and to share and to find community, even though I was myself a little bit shy and awkward as an individual. So it's just channeling something, really. You're just being used, really, by the music. And you know, I'm not saying that, and I'm good at remembering other people's songs and at parties. I quite like being the human jukebox. They'll say, "Do you know that Fred Neil song? Or do you know that Tim Harding one?" Or all that, and yeah, I do actually. You know, I quite like it. Sometimes I make them up, but yeah, I
How did
just
you?
love music. Music transports me. It's like some people, it's a drug. It's like meditation. I play every day, just to play, really, just to release the dopamine, just to get high because I love playing music. And then that might turn into a song or an idea.
How did you meet Kim Mazel?
Oh, how did I meet Kim Mazel? I was doing a song. I was hanging. I was at Paul Weller's studio, and another guy there was Marco from the Young Disciples. I don't know if Marco Nelson. And I had been to Chicago under the strict instructions of Hector, who was the DJ I shared a flat with, and I'd gone and bought all these records for him very early. This would have been 80, 86, 85, 86. But Marcel Jefferson, all that stuff, very early, of which Kim was part. So I brought those back, and I'd hear this house music and all that. And what were we doing? Whoops There Goes the Neighborhood. And I had samples at home. So I started experimenting. And I came up with Wait, and I thought, I'll do this on my own. I'll do this as a solo single. I quite like this, you know, club music and all that. And so I got Sam Brown in to do it initially, who I've got a connection with because Jo Brown, her father, played on one of our records. And I think her mum, Vicky Brown, sang on some T-Rex. Anyway, Sam did it, and she did a great job. But her record company said, or her manager said, "No, I don't think it's right for her," because she was about to release something called Stop, I think. And I had Wait, and it wasn't right for her. So my friend who was a journalist, Paolo Hewitt, said, "Oh, this Kim Mazel is in town. Why don't you get her to come in?" So quick as a shot, I was onto that, and she came in. I actually kept a bit of Sam Brown's vocals. I don't think I've ever told anyone that, least of all Sam. And Kim came in, had a brandy, and whoo, blew the place off. And she was perfect for it because she's a proper house diva, you know. And that was just fun. That was just an extraordinary experience, really, because it was a different audience, different world. The way that record was promoted, everything just happened in a different way. I did it under my name, Robert Howard. I think so the people kind of took a little while to click on who it was and all that. So yeah, that was real fun. Yeah, real fun. I mean, I recorded it in 2 days at the townhouse. It was super fast.
Well, I knew Kim quite well in that period, and we spent a night in New York in Christopher Street and went to a I don't know, gay bar, gay club, and there were drag queens singing. Kim was in the crowd standing at the back and just blew everyone away with her voice. You know, it was just amazing. I mean, she has the most powerful voice and personality. I mean, she's a really powerful person, I think.
Very.
I want to get on to where you are today, because you're on your 12th studio album. You're a band that has been touring now, I think, since about 2007. You've been back on the road. And the album's called Together Alone. Can you tell me something about the album and what you're going to be doing with it, so to speak, where you're going to be going with it?
The albums are often reactions to the ones before. The one before that we released a couple of years ago was a kind of called Journey to You, was a very almost the quintessential Blow Monkeys record, if you like, if there is such a thing. There were strings, there was a lot of big production, da 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 da. And it did really well for us. And so Together Alone, I wanted to bring it right back down to basics. And because we've been playing live so much, I really enjoyed the sound of just the four of us playing. So I wanted to get something that was stripped down and funky. Except for the single, which has got a bit of strings on it. But, you know, and we've got an incredible drummer, Crispin Taylor from Galliano. He was in Galliano, who's very, very funky. So it just brought out that kind of aspect. But also, again, I've touched on things on the album where I haven't really gone before. Things like Rope-A-Dope, sort of almost like Buddy Holly, you know, or the kind of early sort of rock and roll things. But, you know, trying to blow monkey them up. And, I'm not going to give you a synopsis too much, because it's not really for me, because I probably undersell it, but I just try to follow whatever comes out and don't edit myself these days. And I love the whole process of playing live, and I still love the process of making records and playing new tunes to people and seeing the whites of their eyes when we play them. That's still a thrill. I mean, that's still the best part of what we do, is playing live in the moment. In those kind of moments, what they say in Spain, they call it duende. It's like there are moments when you're playing where there's a loss of self with the audience and you, and you're just trying to get to that moment, a kind of communion. And that's, I'm addicted to that. And that's what I do. That's really the core of what we do, is just play music to people. It's not about image or production or records or fame or the cars, or it's about playing to people in those moments. And I can't just be like a nostalgia act. I don't want to do that. So we've made a lot of new records over the last few years, specifically for that very reason. That's what keeps me interested. That's what keeps us alive and in the moment and going. It's a thrill. You know, we're going to go out next week, in fact, and I'm going to play a couple of tunes straight away from the new album that no one's heard before. And I know that's a risk, and I know that bands of our kind of vintage tend not to do that. And if we played it safe, we could probably play bigger venues and do bigger festivals and all that. But I can't do it. I just can't do it. I come back to that kind of thing that I realized back in 86, that I'm shit at showbiz, you know. I can do it. I can do it for a while, but I need to be able to express something new. I need to tell you where I'm at right now and what I found out and what I believe is to be the case. And do you think that as well? And what about this? And maybe just write a song about my relationships and my love and the journey and all those things that just tie us together. So that's all it is. Same as ever, really.
Well, Robert Howard, Dr. Robert, shit at showbiz, but brilliant at music and lyrics. And your album's available for pre-order on the Blow Monkeys website. I wish you much success and with the upcoming tour.
It starts next week.
Next week. Okay, brilliant. Well, I better put this out. Okay, Robert Howard, thanks very much. It's been really enlightening. And I really want to thank you, because I think it's really important that you thank people who have really enriched the culture, and there are, you know, as I said before, it's not only digging your seam, but that song in particular was for someone like me an important, really important work. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.